Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines, with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us a little later, stay ahead with just some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, the Trump tariff pause and what it means for the South African economy. Will the 90-day reprieve help the country's beleaguered citrus industry? Transnet establishes a rolling stock leasing company, but is it a workaround because of its failure to deliver reliable freight services? And also the new role of business in facilitating high skills training. It's Thursday, the 10th of April. Now, as you're probably well aware now, the global trade landscape has shifted again. U.S. President Donald Trump has announced a 90-day pause on higher reciprocal tariffs for most countries while simultaneously slapping a hefty 125% tariff on Chinese imports. It's a move that is obviously going to recalibrate trade flows. It will shake market confidence, although there's been a nice uptick in Asia and in South Africa today, and bring both temporary relief and fresh uncertainty, particularly for export-reliant economies like ours. So to discuss what this means for South Africa, for a AGOA and for global trade stability, I'm in conversation with the chief economist at PwC, Lulu Kruchel. Welcome to you and thank you very much indeed. Prior to this pause, South Africa was facing a 30% tariff on key exports to the US. Obviously, that posed significant challenges for local industries. We've now got this 90-day suspension. Are there immediate effects that South African exporters can expect? And maybe more importantly, would the relief be able to be sustained?
Jeremy, I think the big challenge at the moment is just the level of uncertainty. You know, the fact that that happened in the first place, there's been questions about AGOA for a while. And President Trump actually, you know, making statements to the that indicated that he is not going to potentially renew AGOA come September. So it was already creating a lot of uncertainty in the market. If you look in particular, let's take vehicle exports as an example. That was one of the products that was, you know, a part of the AGOA agreement. And the question was now, with his announcement last week with his 30% tariffs, does that mean AGOA falls away? Legally, the feedback that I got was no. It had to go through a decision of U.S. legal routes first before it could, you know, they could get to a point where they say AGOA was not in place anymore. But the thing is, it has created so much uncertainty in the market. So I would be surprised if South African exporters to the U.S. do not consider their options in any way. Who knows where this is going to end up after the 90 days? Maybe smaller tariffs, maybe no tariffs, who knows? I think the level of uncertainty that this has created for exporters to the US has actually already caused the damage that it can cause, if I could put it that way.
And Lulu, particularly for a sector like the citrus industry, there were fears there of up to 35,000 job losses. This tariff pause is not really going to alleviate those concerns.
No, if you think about the citrus industry, so you know, in terms of monetary value, it's not the biggest industry in terms of exports to the US. But for that particular industry, the US is an incredibly important market. So obviously, I know that the industry has been looking at alternative markets for a while, like China, for example, like other parts of Europe, Asia. So even before this, they've been saying, well, we maybe need to diversify where we are exporting our goods to. Something like citrus, though, you could potentially argue that would the types of tariffs and increases that we're talking about, given the type of product it is, really completely destroy demand? Potentially not, but it's a question that and an uncertainty that producers in that sector just can't deal with. So Yeah, again, if it was me, I would be looking at other options.
Let's move on from exporters to the South African rand. It has experienced significant volatility over the past couple of days. I think hitting its weakest level against the dollar for a while amid these tariff announcements. Lulu, I'm interested to know how closely these currency fluctuations are tied to US trade policies. And is there anything that can be done to stabilize the rand?
Yeah, unfortunately, the reality is what has happened in the U.S. has sent its global markets and the global economy basically into a tailspin. You know, we've said that to each other for years, but unfortunately, the U.S. still has a significant influence as one of the two biggest economies in the world on what is happening. So the massive uncertainty in global markets, unfortunately, has led again, as been the case in the past, to investors saying, well, I want to get out of anything that is uncertain. And on top of that, we know that over the last couple of months, actually, our relationship with, in particular, the Trump government has been contentious. There's been pressure and he's been making announcements and making comments about what is happening in South Africa for a while. So it's definitely been something that is, I think, had an impact on the rand, if somebody's watching the rand in particular. But I suppose the big message is that there is definitely, if you look at developing markets, been a lot of pressure on developing markets. And unfortunately, again, or emerging markets, let me put it that way, South Africa is in that basket.
Lulu, on a wider canvas, we've got the pause on higher tariffs for most nations, but tariffs on Chinese imports escalating to 125%. Inevitably, the selective approach is going to adversely affect ongoing or future global trade dynamics.
Absolutely. China, you know, being, you can basically say the manufacturing hub of the world. You can ask yourself, you know, what their reaction would be. I know we've already seen some of that, you know, with Japan, South Korea, China saying we are going to trade more with each other. And I think that's a trend that we've seen globally for a while now, where regions are actually saying, how are we going to interact in this? An important player that I'm watching as well is how India is going to react to this, because, you know, India is one of those little, well, not little, massive unknowns, but an unknown in all of this. And I think India is sitting on the sideline and saying, well, there's some opportunities for us that we will potentially step into. They are not going to sit back and say, you know, we're just going to see, we're going to miss this opportunity. I think there's some unique opportunities being created for India. And even if you look at Africa, yes, we're a small player as a continent, but this will force Africa and African nations actually to engage with each other more closely and look at options. So this regional blocks, I think, are going to become stronger, which is actually going to isolate the US further.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Lulu Kruchel, who's chief economist at PwC.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
President Trump's dramatic pause on reciprocal tariffs has provided, I guess, a temporary lifeline for many exporters around the world, including South Africa's 1.8 billion rand citrus industry. But it's a reprieve, let's make no mistake, not necessarily a rescue. The 90-day window, I think, gives South Africa's citrus exporters, particularly those in the Western Cape who rely heavily on the US market, maybe a narrow opportunity to recalibrate amidst this global trade shakeup. So I guess the question is, will U.S. consumers absorb higher prices, or will South African producers have to carry the cost? And beyond this brief pause, what strategy then should South Africa pursue in an increasingly unpredictable global trade environment? I'm in conversation now with Dr. Marlene Lowe, who's a senior economist at Absa Agribusiness. Marlene, a very warm welcome to you. So let's start with the basics. This 90-day delay, how significant is it, and how are you interpreting it? Is it relief, a delay, or a warning?
So it's definitely relief, I think, on two fronts. The first is that the citrus export season is imminent, although the volumes would only peak towards July and October. it provides us with a bit of a gap, just as you rightly mentioned, to recalibrate and to reassess what the impacts could be if it was reinstituted after the 90 days. I think all parties concerned, be it government or private sector, now gets the opportunity to fully assess what could be the opportunities and risks, and then also what is the alternatives that could arise if it was reinstituted after 90 days.
So as we speak right now, then, what do you see as, one, the risk, and two, the opportunities?
So the risk, I think, maybe rather obvious, but is that it's reinstituted after 90 days. We export the bulk of our volumes into the US from July to October. So if it was reinstituted in June, that would still have a very notable effect on our season. I think the opportunities is that we can now engage with the different stakeholders within the value chains to assess how agile are we in entering other jurisdictions, and also what would be the cost and opportunity costs associated with it.
But those other jurisdictions are never going to make up for the volume, surely, that we rely on as far as the United States is concerned.
No, definitely. But I think there could be a shift in where citrus is sourced from in terms of US procurement. So typically, the season or the marketing window that we export in, our competing exporters are Peru and Chile. And so if it became apparent that Peru and Chile are more competitive due to a 10% tariff instead of a 30% tariff that we face, Peru could potentially channel more volumes into the US, which could open up market space within the EU. But I think what is important to note is not all markets are created equal. Consumer preferences differ, packaging, size counts, etc. is all issues to consider when you're entering a specific market. And there, I think it might not be as easy as just to move volumes from one jurisdiction to the next.
But whichever way we look at it, the Western Cape specifically is the only region in this country with access to the US citrus market. So whichever way we skin this over the next 90 days, the province remains exposed, and there would be surely dire local economic consequences if we become uncompetitive, as you've suggested.
100%. So I think the big story there over the longer term is really about market access. If you look at other market disruptions such as COVID and the war between Russia and the Ukraine, if we consider an example such as wine, those two events really caused us to lose market share into Russia, which we haven't yet regained. So I think that tells a story of, if you lose your shelf space, it takes years and years to rebuild that. And so it's really a case of weighing the options in terms of how long these tariffs could last. Is it worthwhile to take some temporary pain to retain market share? Or should it be a case of diverting volumes and exploring new opportunities? And I think this is where the additional 90 days just gives us a chance to kind of catch our breath.
Marlene, on a broader canvas, though, the message from the United States seems to be that trade agreements are becoming more politically driven than rules-based. So how should the South African agriculture sector more widely be responding to the shift in global trade norms? It's not just about the citrus industry.
Precisely correct. I think government, organized agriculture, and even private sector stakeholders would do well in investing in capacity to understand the technicalities around trade. So be it market dynamics or the technical trade law issues in question, or even scientific considerations that pertains to animal or plant disease. I think to date, that capacity has not been where it should have been. And we can even expand on that from where we are at the moment, just to make sure that we are in a position to negotiate bilaterally. As you've rightly mentioned, it seems that those type of negotiations would be the way forward and not the rule-based system as governed by the WTO.
And just finally, I think you're also going to suggest that we need to become a little bit smarter as a sector. You say in this report that understanding law, economics and science in trade is now going to become more essential. So what kind of capacity building or institutional support do you think the agri sector urgently needs? Because patently you're suggesting that there are deficiencies there.
Well, maybe not deficiencies, maybe a bit of a case where we are working in silos and we are driving specific trade access one by one. I think over the last couple of years, we've seen great collaboration between the government and organized agriculture. But I think that can go even further to include broader stakeholders to the agricultural sector, be it financiers or insurers, to really create the financial capacity to get the resources that we require to fully understand the implications of the trade terms that we enter into.
Thank you very much indeed for that assessment. That's Dr. Marlene Lowe, Senior Economist at Absa Agribusiness. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
After years of operational and financial difficulty, Transnet is now taking a bold step in its rail reform journey. This week, the state-owned entity issuing what is termed a request for qualification to establish something called LeaseCo. Essentially, it's a rolling stock leasing company aimed at revitalizing South Africa's freight rail sector. But this is my question. Can this new model really level the playing field? Is it going to attract meaningful private investment and fix a freight system that, as we well know, has been a drag on economic performance? Or is this simply a repackaging of old problems in a new language? I'm in conversation now with Yolisa Kani, who's Group Chief Business Development Officer at Transnet. Yolisa, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. What then is the thinking here? What is Transnet's intention?
Look, there are three parts to this initiative, and it's not a new initiative, just by the way. When we first conceptualized it, we're looking at the possibility of diversifying or densifying the North-South Corridor, which is the rail line that goes all the way from South Africa to the DRC, because there's opportunities for cargo southbound and northbound, which is a lost opportunity. But fast forward to where we are today, there are three reasons for this initiative. One, it is to diversify and grow our revenue as Transnet. Your opening remarks are basically where we were about 18 to 24 months ago, where our volumes were on a slippery slide, on a downward trajectory. We then developed what we call a recovery plan. You'll be glad to know that we've stabilized and the volumes are going up. Secondary to that, obviously, we are now reinventing ourselves for growth. So this initiative, first and foremost, is to therefore diversify and grow our revenue by leveraging the capital from the private sector whilst using our stranded assets, which are assets that are not being used. Second to that, and again, it was part of your introductory remark, is to enable the rail reform by making this much sought-after rolling stock available to new train operating companies. You will recall that the infrastructure manager called for any train operating company that would want to take up a slot on the network to do so, and that process was closed at the end of February. 98 companies applied for slots, and that capacity that they envisaged to take up, whether they are successful or not is another conversation, of about 100 million tons. Obviously, if you have access on the network, you will need a rolling stock. So we are hoping to then come to the party with our rolling stock and enable these train operating companies. Again, as I said, these are existing assets, Jeremy. They've just been left stranded and not being utilized. Right. And it's the quickest way of getting rolling stock as opposed to new builds that take anything between 12 to 24 months. And last but not least, obviously, it is to enable regional integration by, again, using the very same assets and making them available to regional train operators. That, again, Jeremy, would then, using our expansive rail network, you know, it's about 21,000 kilometers of a rail network, which then connects the hinterland to our very same ports in South Africa, in particular the port of Richards Bay, right, and the port of Durban.
So this is a very bullish outlook that you're giving me. But let me ask you this. Why should the private sector trust Transnet again, particularly after years of underperformance and broken infrastructure?
The two things that have happened at Transnet, Jeremy, and numbers don't lie, as I've indicated, I just can't speak to the numbers right now, is that we come from a place where our volumes are on a decline. We come from a place where our ports were struggling with ailing and old port equipment. If you check out in the news, we've now received a lot of equipment in the port of Port Elizabeth. I think it's about 100 straddle carriers that are to be delivered in that port, if not yet delivered. The same in the port of Cape Town. We've tried to look for a private sector partner in the port of Durban, but unfortunately that is locked up in a court debacle. Second to that, our volumes have gone up. We've improved. It's a significant improvement from 2 years ago. And the third thing that I'd like to say is that Transnet, for all intents and purposes, is now, I suppose, establishing itself as a business as opposed to a government entity. Government entities get government subsidies, which we don't. We raise our capital by raising debt and from our operations. So I suppose if you look at also most importantly is the stabilization of the leadership as well. So all of those things combined, I think, make us a formidable partner.
You talk about leveling the playing field, yet the private sector might argue that Transnet still controls critical infrastructure. So is this partial liberalization just dressed up as reform?
No, it's a full liberalization. I'll tell you why I say that. Transnet Freight Rail used to be responsible for maintaining and managing the network. There has been a full vertical separation. We now have TRIM, which is the Transnet Rail Infrastructure Manager, which is a regulated entity. That's the entity that advertises slots on the network. The very same TFR has had to apply for slots like everybody else. They will now then run the trains like any other train operating company. That's the first one. The second one is TNPA is also in the process of being corporatized. That was supposed to happen by end of March, but we asked for an extension because there are certain things that we still needed to tie up. So it's a full liberalization of freight and logistics, both from a port as well as rail point of view. And again, it's not something that is driven by Transnet. We are participants like everybody else. This is part of the freight and logistics roadmap that was approved by Cabinet about a year or so ago.
One of the problems, though, is that LeaseCo is going to depend on a functioning logistics ecosystem. And you will concede that ports, rail lines and operations still remain vulnerable, one, to sabotage, that's been widely reported in the past, as well as inefficiencies.
100%. But, you know, what has happened in the past couple of, let's say, 18 months, we have now collaborated with our customers. We no longer call our customers. They are now our partners. Let's give you an example, Jeremy. The challenge that we have with cable theft is a challenge that is being tackled by both ourselves and our customers. We are jointly attacking this unfortunate challenge that is quite pervasive. In some instances, they bring in the drones or they run shifts in the evening whilst we run shifts during daytime. I mean, we have a way of setting those costs. In some cases, it's a payback. In some cases, the customers are more than happy to forego those costs. We also, through the National Logistics Crisis Committee, which has various work streams, one of those work streams is the safety and security work stream. So the engagements at that level obviously hands over that responsibility to SAPS and the rest of the safety and security driven by other government entities that have the mandate and much more intelligence than we do to handle the situation. So there is a collaborative approach to this. Granted, we have not fully addressed the issue, but it has somehow been reduced. So that's the first part. The second part is, you probably would have seen in the papers that the Minister Barbara Creasy, sent out an RFI to the market to test their appetite, the market's appetite, to jointly invest in the rail infrastructure, whether it's in the form of concessions or JVs, whatever the case may be. Freight and logistics framework, first and foremost, the principle is to say that we need to bring back cargo back on rail, but we understand that government has financial constraints, and therefore we're going to be leveraging the private sector to come in and participate. Those two things combined should, and I'm not saying that the matter has gone away, but those things combined should give you comfort that something is being done.
I just need a very quick answer in conclusion. You will guarantee that safeguards are in place to make sure that LeaseCo isn't monopolized by politically connected bidders.
100%. If you read that RFQ, it's quite clear that we're looking for companies that have experience in leasing. They have the financial capability to raise funding. And there are very strict governance structures that we've had to even go through before we went to the market. Jeremy, I would safely say that that era is in the past.
Yolisa Kani, thank you very much indeed. Group Chief Business Development Officer at Transnet.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, access to quality higher education in South Africa remains deeply unequal. It is a reality that's shaped by history and is compounded these days by economic hardship and challenged by limited capacity in our public institutions. So as thousands of deserving students are locked out of an opportunity, are there practical steps that can be taken to open doors, but not only open them a whole lot faster? I'm going to talk now to the Deputy Registrar at the Independent Institute of Education, Taryn Migachev, and I want to examine some urgent priorities to ensure that in the future, and hopefully in the not too distant future, no South African is denied opportunity because of where they come from. So Taryn, welcome to you. And let's be honest here. It's fair to say that many talented young South Africans are simply finding university out of reach. And that problem is becoming exponentially bigger, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is a problem that we see grows year on year. And almost hundreds of thousands of students annually find it near impossible to get access to quality higher education.
So in your opinion then, how are public universities and the funding scheme NSFAS continuing to fall short?
So from my side and from our experience, NSFAS falls short in that it is meant to be assisting students from underserved communities, and it does serve to a certain extent supporting the breaking financial barriers to entry. But NSFAS is really aimed at studies of public institutions. Private higher education institutions may have bursary programs or scholarship funds, but students who attend private higher education institutions, unfortunately, are not eligible for NSFAS funding. And unfortunately, private institutions, which are not government subsidized, and are at a disadvantage in that we don't receive those students. However, we are able to expand capacity much more readily than a state university.
But the reality is because private institutions aren't subsidized, they're perhaps not scaling quick enough to meet the demand fast enough.
Well, absolutely. And there are limitations on both sides. And that's where a better relationship between government and private institutions could foster that growth at a more reasonable rate that would better support the volume of students that are seeking to further studies after they finish their schooling.
So what does a better relationship, in your opinion, entail?
Well, I think in the first part, what we do have to do is start looking at the restriction of NSFAS funding to only going to public universities. Private institutions are subject to the same regulatory requirements, the same accreditation requirements and oversight. We fall under the same governing systems. So the restriction that the funding is only available to students who choose to study at public universities, who do have limited capacity, is something that we need to reconsider.
NSFAS might argue that it is financially stretched anyway in providing funding to those seeking an education at public universities, though. It's simply a question of not having enough.
Absolutely. And there will always be that conflict. And that is where opening that conversation between the private industry and government and NSFAS to see how we could better support the overarching imperative of access is really, really important.
So, Taryn, in that respect, then, does that conversation happen or is it happening?
It is a conversation that is very briefly touched on, but in our experience, it's not something that's growing and it's not something that's an immediate consideration. NSFAS obviously has multiple administrative considerations to take into account, and the volume of students that they are already supporting obviously is a large load as well. So that it is a conversation where that partnership needs to be strengthened and the conversation needs to be taken seriously in order to support students seeking this access.
You also mentioned alternative admissions routes. What would those be? And is that an indictment maybe against public universities that maybe have outdated criteria?
Certainly not an indictment from my side, but simply that there is a different approach to admissions when it comes to private institutions. Private institutions tend to recognize the need for inclusivity, and we understand that sometimes what is considered a traditional admission criteria might exclude a student who has come from a disadvantaged background due to our educational inequalities. A simple example of this would be consideration of mathematics requirements to access certain qualifications. From a private provider perspective, perhaps mathematical literacy achievement would be considered in order to support those students. And then, of course, counter to that, what the private institution does is add in additional support layers because we recognize that the admission requirement is a little bit different, and we therefore are in a position to be able to provide additional support to the students to promote their success.
Are you also raising the issue, if I'm hearing this correctly, that there is more to it mm-hmm. than just what a student gets in matric?
Absolutely. Matric is a point in time. It is an examination that a student is writing, and it's a very high-stakes year for a lot of students. And bearing in mind that these are learners who are 17, 18 years old, that cannot be the true reflection of a person's capability and their ability to study further. Recognizing also that higher education is a different shape of learning. It is a different environment. And students who may not necessarily have thrived in a schooling environment might be the best suited to be thriving in a higher education environment.
So how do you extend it beyond just what a matric result is then?
So we can look at items like experience. There are policies in place, for example, recognition of prior learning and matters like that, where we look at the experience that a student has and what they bring forward outside of their matric results. Remembering that private higher institutions also, obviously, and all higher education institutions, allow alternative admission routes through things such as mature age. Higher education is not limited only to school leavers, but to anybody who's looking to up their skill set and promote their careers going forward. So giving consideration to a person's experience in the world, their adult life, etc., is something that can support their access to higher education.
What happens if the current trajectory continues? What impact is this going to have on people exiting tertiary education? And that, of course, has a direct impact on the economy and success and growth, doesn't it?
It would have an impact. Unfortunately, there's going to become an ever-increasing capacity problem. There will be more and more learners year on year who are seeking to study further, who are seeking to gain the skills and the knowledge from higher education, and they're simply not going to have those opportunities, which leads us to having a larger and larger workforce who have the minimum qualification of completing a matric.
Well, a lot of food for thought there. That's the Deputy Registrar at the Independent Institute of Education, Taryn Migachev. I appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. Join us again tomorrow. We are live at noon, then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.